Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Thursday, December 17th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the executive editor of the American Prospect, David Dayen, and the COVID relief bill, and Joe Biden's determined reluctance to use his power. Meanwhile, the House Oversight Committee reveals that the White House ran a secret herd immunity strategy, wanting more Americans to get infected with coronavirus. This on a day where 3,600, or I should say yesterday, 3,600 Americans died of the coronavirus, 245,000 infected yesterday. The FDA Moderna panel to vote later this day as the Pfizer vaccine distribution hits snags, but also bonuses across the country. Meanwhile, 8 million Americans have fallen into poverty since the end of June, and stimulus checks, unemployment benefits ran out. State AGs line up to sue Google for antitrust violations over its ad technology. Oklahoma Republicans are planning to introduce a bill in that state outlawing abortion. New report, 50 years of tax cutting for the rich has had zero economic benefit, but has led to a major increase in wealth inequality.
Hey, what happened?
Trump's SEC votes to promote foreign resource extraction, and the Supreme Court to hear the NCAA's appeal, whether they can keep athletes working for free. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. We're speaking from somewhat snowy New York City. Emma, glad you could make it into the studio today.
Yeah, I trudged through snow so I could be here with you, Sam.
Well, I appreciate that. I trudged as well. One of the things about New York is that when it snows, even when you get like 7 or 8 inches, every corner is really just a massive puddle of water.
Yes.
And so it's...
some sidewalks paved, some sidewalks not. Right now it's in...
Shoveled.
Shaved, I should say. I mean,
shaved.
Geez, we're really on our P's and Q's this morning. I do like this part of the snow in New York. Soon, in like a few hours, it's going to get all sludgy
and dirty. Disgusting.
Yeah, but it's beautiful right now.
Right. There is like a couple hours at like 5 in the morning where the city more or less looks like, when you get this kind of snow, looks like it did in, you know, the 19th century.
Right.
And that's pretty cool. But it is short-lived. Ladies and gentlemen, I mentioned at the top, 245,000 cases yesterday, according to the New York Times map and case count. 3,600 people, I should say 3,611 people died. There were 113,000, a little more, who were hospitalized. Generally, the rule of thumb has been to take the figure, number of cases, multiply by 1.4% between there and 1.8%, and look out 16 to 21 days, and you will get that figure. Now, I went back, and it appears, at least, that if you look 16 days ago, figures were closer to 200,000 infections. So the percentage, the death rate, seems to be on the higher end of that 1.4 to 1.8 range. And at one point, and we may be seeing it now. It's very difficult to tell from this data. We're going to get to the point where part of the death rate is a function of the inability for hospitals in certain areas of the country to care for everyone to the extent that they can, because they are over capacity. And so they begin to make choices. I suspect that is happening in some hospitals around the country. They don't necessarily advertise this fact, but it is the case that we are hitting capacity in many places. There was an unbelievable statistic as vaccines are rolling out around the country. New York City has vaccinated, I think, 5,200 healthcare workers as of today. In Rhode Island, over the course of a 3-day period, one in 325 Rhode Islanders got infected with COVID.
It's unreal.
And
over a 3-day period.
Over a 3-day period. And one third of the state got infected over a 3-day period. It's obviously a small state, both geographically and in terms of population. But nevertheless, that is stunning. And this is there is no reason to believe that even as we sort of are plateauing, at least over the course of maybe the past 5 or 6 days, I would imagine there's going to be travel leading up to Christmas. We saw a Thanksgiving surge, and I would imagine we're going to see another surge, but we are at levels that are in many places around the country unsustainable. So be safe. Be safe. And there's today they're going to vote on the Moderna vaccine, the FDA panel, the advisory panel. And there's every reason to believe that they're going to approve it based upon what we've heard so far. We got to wait and see. If that's the case, expect the Moderna vaccine to be rolled out probably, I would imagine, starting Monday or Tuesday of next week. And
vaccine seems to be quite safe from what we've seen. I mean, again, we're going to have to see how it plays out, but the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines use similar technology.
That's right. And so it's going to take a couple of months, but folks got to take care of themselves. And this story, we will get to this story. It is shocking. The House Oversight Committee and its select subcommittee on coronavirus has found emails between the Food and Drug Administration Commissioner Stephen Hahn, also Michael Caputo, who was the Health and Human Services Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs. These are political positions, incidentally. Six other senior officials at Health and Human Services. The supposed science advisor, Paul Alexander. And I think his credentials are not stellar.
Well,
says infants, kids, teens, young people, young adults, middle aged, with no conditions, et cetera, have zero to little risk. So we use them to develop herd, .. We want them infected. Now, herd immunity was only tried, or I should say herd immunity as acquired naturally, as opposed through a vaccine, has only been tried, as far as I know, by one society, perhaps in the history, as a conscious policy. In the history of pandemics, and that was in Sweden. And if you go back sometime over the summer, they realized we have made a horrible, horrible, horrible mistake. There has never been a successful public health policy to achieve herd immunity without a vaccine. The idea that they would implement this policy in secret is it seems to me if not literally criminal, as about as, you know, as literal of a metaphorical criminal you can get. This is just, it's stunning.
Yeah, it's stunning. And we already knew that this was the position of the administration, even if they didn't say it out loud, like the way white supremacy is basically the stance of the administration, but they can't fully say it. So they'll just do little things behind the scenes that back up that ideology. I mean, herd immunity, Scott Atlas was brought in because he was in favor of that. And every action by the Trump administration showed that they didn't care about COVID. They were fine with getting it because they have unlimited financial resources and power and access to treatments that other people don't. And they wanted to pretend it didn't exist because they thought it helped Trump's chances of reelection. And that was the whole reason that they went with this. And so this was actually being quietly pushed. Just infect people. Just infect kids. By the way, children, if they have pre-existing conditions, yes, it's rare, but they can die of COVID. It has happened. And of course, young people can die of COVID. Comas, horrible health risks, and psychological issues are being reported.
Here's a graph of Sweden in terms of COVID deaths per million people. I mean, it's way off the charts.
They came to their senses a bit on it, but it's still like harming them because
The problem is that it's very hard to put this genie back into the bottle. Once you train people essentially and signal to them that it's irrelevant what you do. So we have a lot of data now from college towns where you can see the students go back. And even if there was zero risk to 20-year-olds, which there isn't, but even if there was, it is impossible to contain in a society. I don't know if there is a society where you could contain it amongst an age cohort, but in this society it is not possible. I don't know what society it would be possible, but you can see in those college towns spike in deaths when college students come back into those towns.
Also just crazy to implement this strategy without understanding the long-term effects of a disease that just came into the public consciousness at the start of the year. You don't know how it's going to affect people, and now we're seeing there are reports of infertility in men. Yeah. Is that okay if 20-year-olds get it? Mental health issues resulting from it. So many things we didn't know. Such an ignorant, insane position.
And this was done consciously and without the disclosure to the American public. And it'll be interesting to see if there is really any type of like action that can be taken here. But certainly the Democrats should be making this clear that Republicans, lawmakers, administration officials, all, if not fully signed on to this policy, they certainly enabled it to be carried out. We'll be talking to David Dayan, the executive editor of the American Prospect, in just a moment. All right. Do we have David? Okay. Let's bring on. He's the executive editor of the American Prospect and also the author, the writer of his daily newsletter, Unsanitized. David Dayan, welcome back to the program. Always fun to see you.
Hey, happy Chinooka to you.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. Yes, it's the final night tonight, actually.
I know. I'm filled with the Chinooka spirit.
There was a story out there that they were finding that in some of the Pfizer vials of vaccine, that they actually had extra doses in these vials of vaccine.
It's a Chinooka miracle is what that
is. Chinooka miracle, as it were. Exactly. Thank you.
Exactly.
all right. Let's get to, you know, I want to talk to you about a piece that you wrote that was a response to some leaked audio that came out. And I want to get to that because you folks over at the Prospect, I guess a year ago now, or pretty close to, maybe it was a year ago, came out with an extended series of entitled The Day One Agenda, which talked about what a president could do, a Democratic president could do with existing law and simply a determination to to exercise executive action. I want to talk about that in a moment, but let's first start with the stimulus or the relief bill. The latest reporting I saw from Politico was that it looks like they're going to have to work through the weekend for this. Give me your take as to where we are right now. I mean, the big, and there's reporting also that this is hurting Loeffler and Perdue in Georgia. So with those pieces there, give us a sense of like where we are relative to where we should be or where we should be going.
Well, first of all, it's just so sad that members of Congress have to work on the weekend without overtime pay. My heart goes out to them.
My heart's out for them.
Exactly. So let's start there. So we had this bipartisan problem solvers package that was at $900 billion. That became the framework for negotiations between what they call the four corners, which are the Democratic and Republican leaders of the House and Senate. They've been talking for a few days. The things we know a fair bit about what this is going to look like. It's going to look a lot like that bipartisan bill. They took out state and local government relief and the McConnell liability shield for corporations. They have put those aside, said those issues are too contentious. We must move them to the side. And so what's left is a lot of money for small businesses, a PPP, like a second draw of that.
That's really a third draw, right?
Well, I mean, it's a second draw in the sense that now people who got the first PPP can go get a second one. That's what I mean by second draw.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the third time they've re-upped it, but in that second time, it was only for more people to get one. This time, certain people with smaller businesses that have shown continued stress can get a second round.
Okay.
Of PPP relief. So then there's an extension of unemployment. There are two unemployment programs, one for gig workers and one for extended benefits for people whose benefits have run out in over 6 months. Those are both expiring a little over a week from now. So those are extended, and then they're adding $300 a week, about half of what was in the CARES Act, in federal enhancement. There are also, it looks like, and this came in late in the game, is going to be a stimulus check. It looks like that's going to be $600, again, half of what was the CARES Act. Because they brought that in, the unemployment extension, which was going to be for 16 weeks, is now going to be for 12 weeks. This whole thing is capped by a very artificial budget number of $900 billion that Republicans have insisted on. And so everything you add to it, you have to subtract something else. And there's been this maneuvering, they added the stimulus checks. And so now they have to pull out some of the unemployment benefits and so on and so forth. And so what you have is like sort of a hacked away, chopped version of maybe the bill that Pelosi and Trump were talking about before the election. You're looking at something that's around $900 billion. There's some talk that like, oh, this isn't new. There isn't a lot of new money in here,
right?
Because they're rescinding the money cannon, the Federal Reserve programs. They're taking that money.
This is Treasury.
Allegedly.
This was the Treasury.
Yeah, the Treasury
money,
gave
backing up the Fed's loan program.
Yeah. And it's not a one-to-one relationship because in this the CARES Act, that wasn't counted like for budget scoring. So it's just rhetorical that they're saying we're taking this money and putting it towards this. But in my view, it's exactly what I counseled that you should do to appeal to Republicans. Just say, oh, yeah,
you're a Democrat. This is the right messaging to go about when you're talking about this $900 billion.
Absolutely. They're dismantling the money cannon. And they're giving it to people. Like, what's wrong with that? They're getting rid of the corporate bond purchases. And there were other things you could do with that Fed, those credit facilities, but they weren't doing it. They weren't doing anything with it. So it was really just propping up asset prices as just sort of a big cannon to put off the offshore of Wall Street. So get rid of it. You know, Wall Street's going to be fine. There's a vaccine coming. There's an expectation of increased economic performance in the second half of next year. Great. So you take that money, put it towards the people. The problem is the lack of state and local is going to be really crushing. You know, we're going to see cuts to public employees, cuts to public safety, cuts to teachers, all of that stuff. Even what was in the bill was only about a third of what was needed. And now there's not even going to be that. So that's really, really bad. And then there are other just really egregious things, both in the bill and both sort of that are consequences of the way things go. I had a piece today, my unsanitized piece, talks about the fact that unemployment benefits are taxable at the federal level. And very few, if anyone, withholds money from their unemployment check because they need all that money to live. And so when they got this big boost of $600 a week in the summer, and potentially more, you know, after this bill, all that money is taxable, which means that in February of next year or March of next year, when people do their taxes, they're going to realize instead of getting a refund like they usually do, if they're, you know, the working poor and eligible for the earned income tax credit or child tax credit, they're going to owe money now. And people have sort of a biorhythm where they rely on that refund.
Right.
And they expect it, and they pay bills off it. They buy deferred maintenance, like durable goods, a refrigerator's broken. Oh, when I get that refund, I'm going to replace that refrigerator. That's not going to happen. It's targeted anti-stimulus. It's literally targeted at unemployed people who are unemployed during the pandemic, the most vulnerable people. Congress can do something about that. You can just say that unemployment benefits since the pandemic from that moment forward aren't taxable in the 2020 tax year.
Right. I mean, presumably, if you have this artificial $900 billion cap, 180 or so or 160 or so is off the table anyways, because that's going to be, you know, tied up in this liability provision. I would imagine that number that's left over, the 720, well, or whatever it is.
Not necessarily. Okay. Well, because the stimulus checks weren't in that 900. So that's the replacement.
Okay. I see.
But still, I mean, this is literally the worst thing you could possibly do, is to have unemployment benefits be taxed in February and March at the worst possible time for the people who can least afford it. I mean, there's nothing worse here. So I think Democrats have a move to make here, where they say, you know, Republicans, are you going to look a tax cut in the mouth, right? Like a gift.
Yeah.
Like,
and on this? Top of are that, going, there aren't Republicans trying to stop double dipping, as they put it. If you receive a, stimulus check of whatever $600 or $700, whatever it ends up being, unless Democrats hold out for more, because they do have the leverage with McConnell being desperate here. John Thune was saying that, oh, we should prevent, if you're getting unemployment checks, you shouldn't be getting the stimulus or vice versa, which is insane, especially on top of what you're saying.
We should also say,
because the benefit of this. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that on top of this billing that's going to happen come April, presumably we also have a situation where these eviction moratoriums are going to end at one point. And so people are going to be facing
their eviction in the bill.
They're extended in the bill, but at one point they're going to end. And people presumably are getting evicted because owe back rent, right? I mean, so there's all these bills that are going to come
there's
up.
Also, yeah. I mean, you're right. There's also $25 billion in rental assistance, apparently, in this bill, which is very good. Although I don't think that's going to be enough. The other thing about this is that because unemployment benefits are treated as income for tax purposes, that means that because of the way we do federal benefits, where they're tied to income and there's a means test, things like food stamps, people will become ineligible for them because they took unemployment. Benefits like tax credits for the Affordable Care Act, for the exchanges, will be clawed back because you made more money in the 2020 tax year because of your unemployment benefits. So there are a host of ways that people are going to get very unexpected tax bills next year unless Congress does something about it. And just to that double dipping point that Emma made, there's a real double dip here in this bill that subtly changes tax law around the PPP, where recipients of the PPP, which is a reimbursement from the government, it is a federal grant, essentially. It's a forgivable loan. It's a grant. They not only is that tax-free, which it already was under the CARES Act, but you can now use it as a deduction. So this is in the new bill. There's this language that you can use that as a deduction and lower your tax rate as a business in your business taxes. And this double dip, and Lee Fang wrote about this at The Intercept, it could cost as much as $100 billion to the federal government, particularly to people who have set up S corporations, like corporate tax structures, and they can just use that, a new deduction that they got from the PPP, to lower their overall tax rate. Absolutely crazy, and Democrats should demand to take that out.
I'm unclear on how that works. So there's a loan. You pay your employees with that loan. I think you're allowed to also pay your rent with that loan. You then the government says, okay.
And then you get loan forgiveness.
Then you get loan forgiveness. So it's a grant.
Forgiveness.
And so what you get to deduct,
and typically
grant
loan forgiveness. I'm sorry. Typically, loan forgiveness is taxable, right? It's like it's treated as income for tax purposes. But they're saying, but the CARES Act said that, okay, loan forgiveness is not going to be taxable in this case. So that's one dip, right? That you get a tax-free grant. However, they're saying also you can take this as a deduction.
This grant
that you got, you can also take as a deduction.
Oh, I
see. So it's a second grant. It's a double dip. It's a double dip. It's unbelievable, and it's absolutely outrageous, and it's got to go.
All right. So finish, and then I want to just go back a little bit to see how we got here.
Well, what I was going to say is that what we know now, and we know this explicitly because McConnell has said it to his own caucus, is that he's a little desperate to get this bill. He said on a call with the GOP caucus that Kelly and David are getting hammered. And he's referring to Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue in Georgia. So he sees the need for this bill to save those races and consequently to save his Senate majority. And so this is leverage that we have not seen Democrats have since March.
Right.
In March, there was leverage because the economy was crashing and particularly big businesses were very worried. The stock market was crashing. That was shored up in the CARES Act. And Mitch McConnell walked away for 9 months after that happened. Now he's back because he wants something.
The second tranche of PPP, I think, this was after the CARES Act. It was the second tranche of PPP, mm-hmm. where there seemed to be some measure of leverage as well.
He wanted that. Yeah, I mean, he wanted more money for small business because Republicans generally support that. And there could have been an opportunity to do something there. But, Pelosi and Schumer said that this is going to be clean. We're going to get our stuff after this.
Yes.
McConnell walked away again.
Let's talk about that. I want to go back there, and then we'll come back to the current leverage.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a lot of time on this program talking about Pelosi's insistence that state and local funding would come afterwards. There was an exchange she had with Jake Tapper that was just calm down. There was you had Andrew Cuomo, you know, saying like, you got to get this now. And that we're talking about, that was April. That was 8 months ago. And it is hard to see in the future how that's going to happen. So that the it is desperately needed. It is state and local funding tends to be the way that you get out of recessions. And it also can be a way to get into them when in its absence. Well, I mean, is there any way to sort of measure the way that the Democratic leadership played this? And this is with the full awareness that Mitch McConnell didn't want to do any of this except for, you know, during that second tranche of the PPP was really the last time you had a bite at the apple. That's why you had Andrew Cuomo and other people at the time saying, you got to get state and local funding now because Mitch McConnell's going to walk away. Can that be measured as anything other than an abject failure of negotiation, of leadership, of awareness as to what's in front of you?
I mean, I would put the bar back in March. You know, that when doing the big bill, the CARES Act, that's when you really need to get everything that you could. And not only state and local spending, but extending the individual relief for the duration of the national emergency. That's what you really needed at that time. The second tranche of the PPP was important, but I think that was of lesser importance to McConnell. He really wanted corporate America to be bailed out, and he got that, and then he just sort of walked away. The second tranche of the PPP was a nice to have, but it wasn't a must have the way that the corporate bailout was. And now he's in another must have situation, right? We have he thinks that if he doesn't pass this bill, and he has said, we are going to pass a bill. We are not leaving here until we pass a bill. So when someone says that, you should, the wheels should be turning among Democrats that they know that they're in a position of leverage. They have the ability to dictate some terms here. And at least get rid of some of this egregious stuff that's in this bill. But also to extend unemployment benefits to the time that they're needed, to increase the size of the stimulus check, to add the state and local government spending that was allegedly shelved. I guess there's another thing that they're talking about, which is it's half the amount of the 160 that was in the bipartisan bill. It's a $90 billion tranche that goes to FEMA. So it gets doled out by FEMA for on an emergency basis, which sounds like, you know, it's like a Mother May I situation. But we don't have, I don't know. I don't know that Democrats have to accept that because it's McConnell who wants the bill. And but to get back to your question about, you know, this being a failure, look, Nancy Pelosi said it herself. She said, we will have state and local government aid, and we will have it in a very significant way. So you can judge her on that statement she made 8 months ago. And the fact that in the absence of this, you're going to have teacher cuts, you're going to have firefighter cuts, you're going to have schools and you're going to have parks that go unkept. You're going to have infrastructure projects,
programs that are
undone.
Cut.
You're going to have programs cut. Yeah. So, you know, that's what you judge her on. She said it herself. You don't have to speculate.
Okay, let's talk about the leverage point now. And I guess we could also, to fully sort of explicate this history, Pelosi had a chance to take a $1.8 trillion bill that the White House was floating. We don't know exactly what was in it. It's unclear, but there was something there. And at the very least, we know that Mitch McConnell at the time did not want that bill supposedly to come up in the Senate. And there was an opportunity there at the very least to get something and to perhaps maybe put a wedge in between the president and the Senate. I think there was a considerable amount of fear amongst the Democrats that this might help Donald Trump, which I guess is, you know, arguable. I don't know if we can ever know that, but it certainly seems like an arguable point. And Mitch McConnell certainly feels that now, sort of the opposite situation where he needs it for that race in the Senate. But at one point, right, like, I mean, on January 6th, that leverage is gone, obviously, with Mitch McConnell. And if he if they win one of those seats, the ball game is over. At what point do you think the leverage goes away? We know it goes away January 6th. Does it go away January 4th? Does it go away January 3rd or 1st? I mean, far should the Democrats, I mean, this is like sort of a vexing question, right? How far do you push it? And if Mitch McConnell believes that they will lose those two Senate races in Georgia without this bill, do you say, well, you know what? We're going to want a lot more for this. And if it goes away, we're going to take the Senate. And on January 30th, we'll have our own bill.
But then they fall off that cliff of December 26th with unemployment.
Then you have these people suffering for a month.
The eviction moratorium. Yeah. Right.
Well, let's be clear that the people in those two programs, and it's about 13 million people, they're already going to see a lapse in benefits.
Right.
Not enough time to set up the new system. So, you know, that's all the more reason why to get rid of this tax issue, because they're already going to be hit in January with a gap in their cash flow.
Yep.
We're going to hit them again in February with the tax bill. It's crazy. But your question's about leverage. So, you know, January 3rd, a new Congress comes in, right? And that Congress is more conservative on the House side. At the outset, it'll be slightly more Democratic on the Senate side, because David Perdue's term ends on January 3rd, even though the election isn't until the 5th. So it'll be 51-48 as opposed to 52-48 on January 3rd.
And Loeffler's does not?
Loeffler's does not, because she's in a special election.
Right. Okay.
And so she serves until the winner of the special election. So it'll be 51-48. But, you know, I think you need to get something done before the Congress flips over, because then you have a very thin congressional majority in the House. So there's a time limit to this, but, you know, McConnell isn't, you know, the funny thing about Mitch McConnell is he tells you what he thinks. Like, he's
right.
There isn't a lot of artifice with Mitch McConnell. If he's saying Kelly and David are getting hammered, he means it. Like, he actually means it. And he actually is saying, he's like, you don't have to read between the lines. He's saying, I need a bill. And so, you know, what was Ted Kennedy's thing? It's like, you work as hard as you can to get as much as you can. And that's what Democrats should be doing right now.
How do you have a sense of what Ossoff and Warnock, who are running against Perdue and Loeffler respectively, what they are targeting when they go after? I know that they've deployed some ads. Do you have a sense of exactly what they're attacking them over? In other words, like, when we have Sanders and Hawley talking about $1,200 checks as opposed to $600. Even if this gets passed with a $600, you still have this $1,200 club if you're Ossoff and Warnock, I guess, right? Theoretically, to say,
yeah,
you would have had $1,200 were it not for these two and Mitch McConnell.
And this bill is going to be underweight no matter what it ends up and what the parameters are. If it's a $900 billion bill, it's going to be less than what's needed in terms of relief right now. So Ossoff and Warnock are certainly in a position, no matter what, to say, vote for us and we'll get you more stimulus. And right, if you don't vote for us, we're not going to get anything, because this is going to be tied into an omnibus spending bill that will set spending levels until next September. So there won't be another must-pass situation until next September, and which means there's not likely, if it's a Republican majority in the Senate, there's not likely to be any relief until at least then, if not after that. So, you know, I think Ossoff and Warnock have a tale to tell. Are they telling it? I've heard a lot of, I mean, we have a reporter down there right now in Georgia, a guy named Eli Day, who's been reporting on a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I hear a lot from them about the corruption of Loeffler and Purdue, which is certainly fair game.
Yep.
I hear, he covered a labor rally where there was a lot of talk about the PRO Act, which is a pro-labor bill, which is kind of interesting as a wedge issue. I don't know if you get that with 50 votes necessarily, but I know there's been talk of that. And I know there have been some outside ads on $1,200 specifically, like very specifically, like you get this bill, you get this check if these guys come in. It hasn't been super coordinated, though. Maybe not to the extent that it should be. And maybe these talks, which are a bit uncertain, have kind of tempered that a little bit. But it's certainly fair game, I think, for both Ossoff and Warnock to say that, the path to more relief for the American people goes right through us.
I want to get to this point about the day one agenda and Biden's reluctance. But before we do, it looks like, because tomorrow is the drop dead day for the omnibus spending bill, this is separate from the relief bill. This is a $1.4 trillion essentially. It's budget. It's the operating budget government of the United States.
Yeah.
And they may have to pass another week. But in your mind, does it make sense for the Democrats to be looking to do an entire year's worth of a bill when there is an opportunity for them to take the Senate, or is it just simply a sort of a more of a defensive position? That way we can be assured that we're going to get 1.4 as opposed to some type of like more severe austerity, I guess, that would come in if it was a Republican controlled Senate.
Yeah, there's pros and cons to it. There's one sense that Biden is going to need to be doing a lot of stuff and doesn't need the threat of a government shutdown over his head early in his administration. So if you did a spending bill to February, then like the first week he comes in, like he's got to figure out how to get a spending bill done. And it probably looks the same as this one anyway. So there's that idea. But the other idea is that if you do this omnibus till September, you kind of foreclose the sort of moments that seemingly Congress only acts during, which are moments of must-pass bills. So there are pros and cons, and it's a bit of a gamble to say, like, I'm betting on Ossoff and Warnock to win, I'm betting that we can get a better deal down the road. There's also this surprise billing legislation that could be part of this whole mix, and there's an energy bill that's being thrown in. So there's a lot riding on this, some of which is pretty good. And so, I could see it either way.
All right. So let's move to this. There was a leaked audio that came out, I guess it was about a week or so ago, from a conversation that Joe Biden was having with some civil rights leaders. And he said in this conversation, paraphrasing, some of my progressive friends want me to take all sorts of executive actions. That's not constitutional, and I'm not going to do it. And then we saw subsequent reporting where he said, believe me, in 6 to 8 months, I may eat my words, but the Republicans are gonna work with me. And this is another, the fever will break. We heard that literally four times, I think, over the course of the Obama administration. Every time there was an election, the fever was going to break. The fever was going to break if the Republicans got power, or the fever was going to break if they lost power. Both those things happened. The fever actually became worse. As so much so that there was foam coming out of their mouths. Your reaction to this? Because in many respects, I think he was talking about, frankly, the day, literally what you guys put together at the Prospect, because that has become different politicians have picked up on this. Schumer and Warren talking about how on day one, Biden can get rid of $50,000 worth of student loan debt for everyone who has it in the country. What's your reaction and what's your sense of this?
Well, I mean, I think the lead characters of Waiting for Godot have less patience than Joe Biden when it comes to the Republican Party. I don't know how many many times reality needs to intervene with him before he understands that. As far as the day one agenda is concerned, I mean, the way I look at it is if someone knew everything I could do in my job and wrote it out over the course of several months and said they were going to hold me accountable for doing it, I probably wouldn't be happy either. You know, I mean, it's unfair to hold me to such a high standard, but I'm not the president, or I'm not going to be the president of the United States. And that comes with the territory. You might not like that people are pushing you to use the clear authority that you have, but those are the breaks. You're the most powerful man in the free world. And so suck it up. And we're not going to stop asking. The truth is, or to use Biden's phrase, the fact of the matter is,
right,
that everything in the day one agenda is 100% constitutional. It's all based on existing authorities that have been given to the president. Literally, the job description in Article 2 of the Constitution is that the president takes care that the laws are faithfully executed. Everything in the day one agenda is based on a law and the ability for the president to faithfully execute it. Everything from student debt, which comes out of the Higher Education Act of 1963, to lowering prescription drug prices, which comes out of the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, to using federal procurement power to give every federal contractor a $15 an hour minimum wage. That comes out of the Office of Federal Procurement from 1974. I could go on and on, but it's not tyrannical. I mean, it's literally the job description of a president to execute and implement the laws. I don't have a lot of sympathy for Joe Biden in this moment for being miffed that people want him to implement the laws.
Do you think he believes it's unconstitutional, or do you think that is, way that this was phrased in this, we should say in this leaked audio, it's one of those things that either it was really weighing on his mind, but it was something that he wanted to get out there to these folks, right? I mean,
I don't think he thinks it's unconstitutional. And here's the reason I know that. The only example he gave in that leaked audio was saying, I can't ban assault weapons by executive order, which is like a straw man because no one's asked him to ban all assault weapons by executive order. However, what he can do under the Gun Control Act of 1968 is ban the importation of certain assault weapons that are not used for sport. And Joe Biden, in his gun control plan, said he would do that. So he clearly knows this is not unconstitutional. His advisors know it's not unconstitutional. He promised to do the thing that he said was unconstitutional. And the entire argument is an excuse for him not to do things that either he doesn't want to push the envelope, show that he's mean to Republicans, get something done. I mean, I don't know why he's necessarily exactly resistant to this. There are a whole lot of theories that you can conjure up, but it's an excuse.
Right. And so if he does wait those 6 or 7 months, I guess, to see, you know, to eat his words about the Republicans getting along with him, I guess it becomes then the day, 195 agenda or something like that. That's the new day one. I mean, on one hand, I'm a little bit alarmed that he's saying that it's unconstitutional because it feels like he's painting himself in a corner. On the other hand, I remember when Nancy Pelosi went on to, I can't remember what late night talk show it was, and said, oh, we can't impeach the president because if we do, he won't be subject to criminal charges afterwards. That was also something that was fantastical fortunately sort of went off into the ether. I imagine, though, that Mitch McConnell, if they wanted to talk about Sean Hannity, if they want to talk about what Joe Biden is doing 195 days from taking office, And he starts working on that day one agenda because it's quite clear the Republicans are not helping with him, working with him. Sean Hannity's going to start playing that audio tape, I guess. And I don't know how much salience that'll have, but it'll have some. They'll have something to talk about.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, the day one agenda is also leverage, right? It's like, I know, Mitch McConnell, that I can do this. And so you better come up with a policy that makes it irrelevant or obsolete for me to do this. And, you know, and a president willing and interested in getting something done, that's how they would pursue it. You know, if Joe Biden wants to be a successful president and if he wants the Democrats to be seen as a party that looks to make tangible progress, he would use every opportunity at his legal disposal to get that done. And I'll preview something here that we're going to be doing. We're going to do a tracker of the day one agenda. We are going to list everything in the day one agenda that we know is available to a president, and we're going to chart whether or not it gets done. And we're going to periodically update that. And so we're watching. The whole point of the day one agenda was kind of to say, we're watching. We know what you can do. You cannot hide behind Mitch McConnell is mean and is making me not do anything. Here's what you can do. And we're going to score it. And we're going to hold you accountable on whether or not you did it.
Well, that is mean of you to do, David. All right.
I know. David, on Chinooka of all times. For
that
me
is
to,
not,
me,
that is
me to
not
do
the
that.
Hanukkah spirit. I mean, actually, in some ways, it really is. But David Dayan, we will put a link to that day one agenda at majority.fm. Folks, you should go and check it out. It is very important for you to know what your politicians can do in service of you and your country, despite the fact that they may not want to do that at times. David Dayan, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right, Sam, thanks. Thanks, guys.
We'll take a quick break. Be right back. We're back, and so we just got a couple minutes here. Let's play some a clip from Fox and Friends. Was this from this morning? I think it was. Yes, this was. And
Fox and Friends B team.
This is. I guess so. Sean Duffy and Rachel Campos Duffy. Are they married? Is that right? I didn't know that. Is that right?
Yeah, he's like the Real World former star. That's now.
Oh, right.
Republican.
Right.
And they are very, very concerned at this notion of these $600 relief checks going out to folks. This, and of course, I think it's capped at people making $75,000, annually or less. But they're very concerned about the idea that people could get used to the idea of during a pandemic getting some type of relief. Play this.
And by the way, if these closures continue, Brian, and the government gives these workers a check for a little while, they're going to have checks for the rest of their life because there won't be any bars and restaurants to go back to work in. They're all going to be closed. We're all going to be forced, or these workers are all going to be forced to be on, you know, the government dole forever because they're crushing these small businesses that won't come back.
Maybe that's the goal.
Maybe.
Well,
maybe it is. That's what they're doing in China. They're consolidating power even more, whatever little bit of free market was left over this pandemic. Chairman Xi has consolidated and made it less so because the middle class has always been the most unruly, feisty group. And that's who you have to control.
Wow. That is
unruly and feisty.
Yeah, that is some very, very grade A ridiculousness and stupidity, I got to say. First off, we know that within this package, there is money for small businesses in the form of the Paycheck Protection Act. The idea that if you pay people to not work at these restaurants for the next couple of months, that there will never be restaurants again, is absurd.
Their friends in private equity will buy new restaurants. They don't need to worry about this.
Well, where are people going to spend this money? The $600, where's it going to go somewhere, and it's going to go into these small businesses, and they'll be ordering takeout for the next couple of months before people get the vaccine and we get through this harsh time.
Or we just become China.
There it is. All right, folks, we'll have more to talk about this tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. And for those of you sticking around, we've got a lot more show for you. The crew is going to come in and take over the fun half today. Emma's going to be joined by old Matt, and Jamie, current Jamie, and new Matt, and just plain old Brendan will be here. I don't know. I have never really come up
plain
with
old
POB. Yeah.
POB.
That's you.
Just a reminder, today on the Nomi Key Show, Harvey Kay, Representative Chris Robb, and Arun Chaudhry will be joining Nomi. You can find that at youtube.com/the Nomi Key Show. And also, don't forget, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the you support the free half of the show, and then you get the fun half of the show. That's the way that we work it, ladies and gentlemen. So check that out. It is your support that makes this show possible, week in, week out. You also get the show commercial free too. And end of year, we tend to have more commercials. I think there's a lot of these like places they use up their budget.
Yeah, well then this is why you got to become a member. So.
Because when he gets there, we start getting in January or February, it gets a little thin.
Yeah. You're going to get used to less commercials, and then, then you need to just...
Then the hammer drops.
Right. That's how we lure you in.
I know you guys are going to probably want to play the dumb Jimmy Dore clip.
I don't know. I mean, we've talked enough about Jimmy Dore.
I'm ready to take a day off from that.
So sick of Jimmy. I wish I had not waited into this.
Yeah, I missed it all.
Yeah, I mean, let's save it for tomorrow, I think.
Well, new Matt is like chomping at the bit, it looks like.
Old Matt,
sorry, I get confused.
It's all right. New Matt's, old Matt's, Matt's in general, they're all the same.
Old Matt is here, and old Matt, what's happening on Doom these days?
Well, today at 9 p.m. on the show, the live stream show, youtube.com/Matt Binder, Doomed Live, we'll be talking about how white supremacists deplatformed from their mainstream networks like YouTube and Twitter and Facebook are forced to use peer-to-peer systems, and basically how they're using these peer-to-peer networks to not only disseminate their material, but also to fundraise, for example, how they have been getting money via Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency. So that's tonight, 9 p.m. Eastern time at youtube.com/Matt Binder.
Did you take that from that guy, Chris, what's his face? Hardwick, that Talk Live thing? He said,
no.
Do Live? I don't know.
I just
know you're a big Walking Dead guy. Jamie, what's happening on the Antifada?
Well, this week on the Antifada, we spoke with Terrence Ray from the Trillbilly Workers Party about the movie Hillbilly Elegy, based on the book by J.D. Vance. We use this as a jumping off point to talk a little bit about the political economy of rural America, deindustrialization, rural poverty, the opioid epidemic, and the appalling ways that poor white people are depicted by U.S. media.
Did you watch that movie?
I did. It was terrible. It made me feel so bad.
It looked horrible. I mean, like, Amy Adams, we love you. This is not the way to get your Oscar.
No, it is not. I'm actually somewhat heartened by the, negative reactions, the negative reception this film has received by not just, leftists like myself, but people who just understand that it's a terrible movie. We talked about the ideological work that this is doing, even though it's presented as an innocent, by autobiography or whatever, and pivoted to talking about J.D. Vance's role at the American Enterprise Institute, where he is colleagues with Charles Murray and kind of kind of bringing up the left wing of this neoliberal exterminist politics. So that was a super good conversation. That's out now, patreon.com/theantifada. Also last night, we had a very fun Twitch stream, which is still up if you want to watch it. Maybe you want to fast forward through the half an hour where I was having technical problems, or maybe you love watching me have technical problems. You don't know. We don't know what people are going to be into, but we had a super chill time. Had a little update from the Staten Island Autonomous Zone where Andy has been reporting on the scene. Jake Flores stopped by for a little bit. We got some subs. We did some poppers. It was a real good time. Twitch.tv/TheAntifada.
And Matt, what's happening on your new Matt? What's happening on your various in your media empire?
Yeah, tonight on Left Reckoning, David and I will be doing a Thursday night stream talking about continued violence against Nova Scotia Indigenous fishermen, the strikes in India, the terminated Professor Garrett Felber, who was a guest of this show previously.
Wait, what? I thought how did we not get him? Brendan was trying to get him.
Oh, no, we don't have him. We're just going to be talking about him.
Oh.
We're still in soft launch, Sam. We're going to talk about food insecurity and the COVID relief. Where the state of COVID relief says about our country right now. So check that out tonight at 7 at the Left Reckoning YouTube page. Subscribe, folks.
All right, folks. I'll be back tomorrow, but these guys will take you into the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
What's up, everybody? How y'all doing today?
On this beautiful
Thursday, you know, if you're in New York City right now, massive snowstorm. I was just, if you see my hair is all wet, it's because I was just outside with the kids playing in the snow.
I love a good snowstorm.
It's actually my 1.5-year-old's first snowfall because it didn't snow at all last winter here. So she got to experience snow for the first time in person.
Aww.
I love it. I hate how little snow New York gets, to be honest. Like I saw all the propaganda about how beautiful New York is during snow. And that was frankly one of the reasons I chose LA over New York for grad school. And I get here and it's just a slush mess for all but like one day a year typically. But that, hey, we're in the one day right now and it's very beautiful.
It's magical.
Weird though because it used to snow a lot more in New York. I mean, this is climate change, honestly. I mean, literally, it used to snow a lot more. It used to be a lot colder during the winter, too. Winters have been pretty warm in New York lately.
Yeah. I feel bad for all the school kids because the mayor has canceled snow days, of course, because they're all doing remote learning now. We actually talked last night a little bit on the Intifada stream. Some New York City school children are promising to take matters into their own hands if the mayor refuses to give them any snow days to go outside and play in the snow, which I appreciate a lot. You know, direct action gets the goods. The sooner kids learn that, the better.
You can hear me, right?
We can hear you. I'm a good.
Perfect. I just wanted to make sure the audio was okay. Did you guys ever do some of those like rituals to try to get snow days? Like if you put a penny under your pillow did you ever do any of those things?
I never heard of anything like that, but I can say the best snow day I ever experienced in my life was it happened on my birthday. I woke up. This was in high school. I woke up and heard that a pipe broke, and so there's no school for that day.
Pipe burst is the best. Yeah. I had a few of those. Water main breaks.
Oh, my God. And so the Xbox 360 had just come out, so instead of going to school, I drove over to Best Buy, bought the video game Condemned, which anybody who has played that knows how awesome that is, and just played Condemned all day on my birthday in my basement.
Wow. What a beautiful story.
Those were the days when like a snow day or a random day off from school was like, it meant the world. And you were able to, and like the few hours that you're off from school that day, it feels like an eternity.
Whoa, I'm hearing a weird echo from you, Matt.
I just heard that too. Yeah, yeah, that was weird.
It looks like it might have sorted itself out now.
All right. Hopefully all of our internets hold out because mine wasn't working so well earlier.
Yeah, I saw in the YouTube chat someone said how our frame my frame rates were dropping, and I was you were getting the that video stutter that you see when it's not a smooth
the robot.
Stream.
I thought you were just doing the robot.
Yeah, that's also a possibility. You never know. I'll keep you guys wondering.
And happy Hanukkah, by the way. I have yet to wish you and everyone in the triple parentheses crew happy Hanukkah. So. There we go.
Happy Hanukkah, everyone. Also, I mean, this is, for me at least, the last Thursday of the year. So happy, I don't know, are you guys, are we working on Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve?
We are not.
Right? No, just
so, you. Just me. I wouldn't mind it, honestly, at least. You know, why not? But anyway, so happy holidays. Before we end the show later and forget about all this, happy holiday, guys, and happy New Year. I hope everyone stays healthy and everyone's family, whoever they're able to see. And, you know, I know we're still in this pandemic and it's getting worse, but whatever you're able to do to celebrate, I hope you are happy and healthy. And after today, I'll see you guys all again on the stream in January 2021.
21, for sure.
Oh, boy.
Can we?
Everyone's mad at a year, but you know what? It might turn out that the problems are still here. I just want everyone to mentally prepare themselves.
Yeah, I've always been one of those people who thought like, oh, people who are like, oh, I hate this insert year so much, or next year is going to be better. I'm one of the people who always like, it's just like a random amount of time that we've just decided to assign years. Like you could change your life whenever you want, but this year does feel a little bit different. Yeah. It does feel a little bit different.
I used to agree, but then 2020 hit, and then that was a specifically terrible year where we can categorize and look at this time as probably the most horrible year that we've lived through. Especially
until the great climate catastrophe. Like,
next year, maybe. I don't want to be a doomer, but this might be a good time.
Here's the difference between 2021, though, and 2020, at least when it comes to the pandemic. You know, March last year, when we were in lockdown mode and things were at its worst until we are now, but things were at its worst, there was no end in sight. We had no idea what was going to happen, how long this would be for, if there would ever even be vaccines. Now, even though it's getting back to that point, there is some sort of light at the end of the tunnel. There are a number of vaccines. Scientists and doctors are feeling very good about this ending sometime at the end of 2021. So, you know, we do see that, you know, there is something to pin our hopes and dreams on. Do you know what I mean?
It's true. I was very excited to go to Barcelona for Primavera Sound, which is like the best music festival in the world, they say. And that didn't happen. So I'm looking forward to when it finally does happen. And I'm sure, you know, as soon as we got our vaccines and stuff is open again, people are going to be so excited to take our money wherever we go. It's going to be great.
Yeah, I think sure. I'm just going to have a live show. I don't know what it'll be. I'll just start another band and have a live show somewhere, and I bet people will just go en masse just to go to a live event, you know?
Well, one can only hope.
Yeah. Then when that happens, we'll be able to publicly make fun of clips like this, but I wanted to get this Buttigieg clip in here because I know
let's do it.
2:30. It was amusing me to no end yesterday. So Pete Buttigieg appointed transportation secretary because he loves the choo-choos and the cars and all of those things and all the wheels. And he had a very curious explanation for why he was qualified to be transportation secretary. It reminded me, he's not stupid like Sarah Palin, but it reminded me of the I can see Russia from my house moment, except said more eloquently. This was Pete Buttigieg yesterday.
I've also had a personal love of transportation ever since childhood. More than once, as a college student, I would convince a friend to travel nearly 1,000 miles back to Indiana with me on Amtrak, though I know that in this administration, I will at best aspire to be the second biggest train enthusiast around. I spent a spring break in graduate school aboard a cargo ship studying there. Travel in my mind is synonymous with growth, with adventure, even love, so much so that I proposed to my husband, Chasten, in an airport terminal. So don't let anybody tell you that O'Hare isn't romantic.
Oh, poor Chasten.
I thought it was Chasten until I saw that. But never mind, because I thought he was so chaste. Seems like, but it's chastity more. Yeah, I don't know.
When I was a kid, I watched a lot of Thomas the Tank Engine. I was a big fan of Shining Time Station with George Carlin and Ringo Starr. Do you guys remember that show?
Yes.
But, you know, for some reason, that didn't mean that I could suddenly become a transportation secretary or work with trains in any which way. And I really loved Thomas the Tank Engine.
Yeah, it's weird how that born on summer nights when we're barbecuing, so that makes me qualified to lead the Department of Agriculture.
Oh my god. Right. And, no, seriously, people are acting like this is just like a symbolic role or whatever, that Biden had to throw him a bone, but like transportation is really important. Like, it's extremely important, and there are plenty of openings for Mayor Pete to apply his, you know, crappy McKinsey neoliberal ethos to, you know, eliminate waste and privatize things, and it's going to be bad, folks.
Yeah, well, it's part of this kind of ecosystem where people who have all these qualifications or big education credentials and who speak a certain way, they're automatically granted credence over issues that they don't even have any expertise in. And so just because he was an early-ish dropout / endorser of Joe Biden, Biden feels he needs to reward him, gives him a position that he really has no experience in over other qualified candidates. There has been reporting on this in this transactional politics. So that's a problem number one. But two, the point I was trying to make earlier is just that it's just because he has a Harvard degree and he talks kind of like a fancy guy. I mean, I saw
And he proposed at the airport. Don't forget.
I forgot about that. I saw young Matt pointed this out on Twitter, that basically most bus drivers would be more qualified than Buttigieg to run.
Yeah,
this
Nathan Robinson was making that point, and there's a lot of people upset and thought he was crazy, but what's Buttigieg's experience? I'd take anybody who had an entire career in any municipal transit authority over Buttigieg. Buttigieg is a Rhodes Scholar, McKenzie guy who, I mean, his military experience was drug trafficking, so not that kind of traffic. And so, like, what is his credential is, oh, he has these amazing, this Rhodes Scholar stuff, right? And then so he'll just be able to understand it better than, you know, somebody who's actually worked these jobs for decades, this guy. Like, I don't know, I rode a train to Seattle and back from Fargo. If I was going to be a transportation secretary, I wouldn't like count on that for my like resume. But
no, that sounds now. Like you might be the next CEO of Amtrak, Matt.
He actually like does. There actually is some record on how Pete Buttigieg handles transportation infrastructure. Did you guys see this? When he was mayor of South Bend, he removed traffic lights from an intersection by a public bus stop that students used to get to their charter school. This is like neoliberal bingo right here. because a consultant said that it was unnecessary or wasteful or whatever. I'm not sure how much money a traffic light could possibly have been costing the city. I don't know if it's like the electricity that it used. Like, it was already there and they put a bag over it.
I don't understand a scenario where you remove a traffic light. Adding a traffic light, adding a stop sign at the very least, that's something you hear a lot of in terms of removing something. I don't mean
if you want to talk efficiency, you want roundabouts, but you know.
So then what happened was an 11-year-old child was killed at that intersection, and Pete Buttigieg kind of blame the kid for running out into the street. You guys want to hear what he said?
Let's hear it.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Following a consultant's 2015 study finding that vehicular and pedestrian traffic at the corner of South and Michigan streets didn't warrant a traffic light, the city placed a bag over it, as well as at a handful of downtown intersections. Someone asked in the comments, why were two young children taking a public transit bus to school anyway? Don't we have school buses to pick them up? And the answer is no. The charter school that they went to did not have school buses to pick them up. And then here is what Pete said, quote, "We simply don't know whether it would have made any difference yesterday morning as two children darted across the street at an angle." And one of them outside the crosswalk, people, was struck and killed.
Yeah.
So, that's all you need to know about a person right there.
The beginning and end of his experience. But to me, just the transactional nature of the fact that he was appointed, basically, he ran for president as a completely naked way for him to step onto the national political scene when he was completely unqualified, and Biden rewarded him for it. That's the thing that sticks out for me. And I almost thought he was too good for transportation secretary, so I'm surprised he took it in some sense, but it is a stepping stone for his next Machiavellian venture.
Well, yeah, he helped him out a lot. He helped him defeat Bernie, and you get rewarded for that, you know?
There were rumors there were rumors that Biden was going to give Buttigieg a non-cabinet position, like a China ambassador or something like that. And Buttigieg was very unpleased with that. Those were the word going around. So I'm sure the fact that he's just going to be in the cabinet, he's happy about, I'm sure.
Maybe there's a silver lining. There's a silver lining to this, because I'm sure Pete thinks that he deserved something more impressive. So, you know, we can take some cold comfort in that as he's outsourcing some private highways and bridges to Elon Musk or whatever.
Well, I think I haven't seen exactly what his authority will be in this regard, but I think, you know, people are excited because Biden loves trains and all these sorts of things. And maybe Buttigieg will be good because of that reason. I hope so. Love it. I would love to see it. But I would also be worried about what he can do with regards to Prop 22, because I expect a full court press from good, you know, party Democrats on making that national. And Pete Buttigieg as a Secretary of Transportation doesn't, you know, at least he's not going to be a ally in the fight against that. I expect him to be an opponent. And
oh, absolutely.
That would be what I would judge his time as of that question. and great, what
great
his
point. And also it's just because you know, Kamala Harris's husband, top lawyer for Uber, also circling around the administration as well, so that kind of influence is going to be felt.
But guys, did you see the news that Pete Buttigieg would be the first openly LGBT cabinet member? Isn't that more important than all this policy and experience and all stuff? I mean, when I saw that, that was what everybody was saying on social media when it was announced that Biden picked Buttigieg to be his transportation secretary. And I just had to point out how to me it was funny that this was what was going on when literally the current transportation secretary, and I pointed this out, who is Mitch McConnell's wife, when she was appointed, the GOP came out and said, ladies and gentlemen, the first ever Asian American woman in a presidential cabinet. And it's just like so funny to me that this is like, this is what we're doing now. This is what we're dealing with now. Like, this is, if the Democrats and liberals want to prop this stuff up, I mean, this is super simple for the GOP to do the same thing on their side when they have someone to boast about, because none of that matters. What matters is where this person stands, what they're going to do, their policy positions, how they want to help you, really, viewer watching at home. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And I don't know what Pete Buttigieg is going to do, but his history of zero transportation experience and his history doing other things points to probably not looking out for your best interests.
No, it does not.
For sure.
You guys want to go to the phones, or do you got anything else you want to?
No. And I'll, after we're done, we'll do some more clips.
Okay, here we go. 702. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, old Matt. It's Bro Flamingo from Las Vegas. What's going on, Jamie? What's going on, Emma?
Hey, Bro Flamingo. What's up?
Hey, buddy. What'd you like to talk about today?
Hey. I know you guys are probably going to cringe about this, but I'm here to rip on Jimmy Dore.
No, it's fine. We spent, you know, more earlier in the week ripping on him, but like, to be honest, I would love to rip on him more, but I almost don't want to, you know, look like a hater.
I actually missed this whole discourse, so I'm looking forward to it, bro. So go ahead. Boy. Let's do this.
Give us a fresh angle on this whole tactical debate between social democrats that has turned nasty and personal.
Actually, you know, it's more of a personal thing. Like, so basically, I was fighting eviction. I'm in Nevada, right? But Governor Sisolak extended the moratorium. So he literally saved me. You know, I mean, literally, politics saved me, you know, because I was battling eviction, okay? But according to Jimmy Dore, since I guess Sisolak isn't, you know, pure enough, or any Democrat isn't necessarily pure enough for him, you know, following this guy, I would have been out on the street. You know, because, you know, he wasn't following whatever Jimmy's narrow definition of whatever politics that he follows. And I see that a guy like Jimmy Dore, he poisons the discourse. And Emma, I saw that clip when you, Nomiki, and Sam, you know, when you see him bullying Matt Stoller. There's nothing funny about that. I mean, the guy is just cursing. He's loud. He's angry. This guy, and also, you know, I'm an online leftist forums, and I do a lot. And I do a lot of, oh, yeah, absolutely. But also, I do like I do direct action. You know, shout out to Jamie, by the way. You know, she talks about direct action, so I started doing it.
Hell
and
yeah.
I realized that anybody, you know, any leftist that's doing direct action or out there, you know, putting in work, Jimmy Dore is literally irrelevant. He's not even in the conversation. I almost feel like he's like an online phenomenon.
Oh, yes.
You know? But I realized that, you know, when he's out there just disempowering people, just talking garbage, and just the absolute – and by the way, he bought a $1.9 million mansion. So the grift is in. You know, see, the grift is super in. That's ridiculous. Anyways, guys, I'll jump. But I'm just saying this guy, he has no idea what he's talking about. He has no strategy. You know, listen, the Democrats suck, okay? We all know that they suck. But they are better than literal full-on fascists, white supremacists, And just, you know, your average dingbat Republican, you know, bending the knee at QAnon, okay? Left is best. I'm jumping. Take care, guys.
Later.
Thanks, man. That was great. Yeah.
No, it's
no,
so.
I mean,
oh, Matt, I'll let you weigh in because we were. I mean, we talked about it on Monday with Jamie, and then on Tuesday again with Nomiki. So,
right? No, I mean, I honestly miss sort of the whole discourse in general, not just on the Majority Report around this, because I honestly pay very little attention to Jimmy Dore. But the idea that that he would, I mean, yeah, it's good that we have different strategies. That, you know, not to throw everything Jimmy Dore set aside. See, so because I'm not completely against what Jimmy Dore was advocating for, but you also have to understand what other people were advocating for when going up against Jimmy. Like, let's take AOC, who was his, you know, an enemy number one in this whole argument. She had a perfectly good answer and reasoning for what she's focusing on and why not to bring the vote to the floor now. And the idea that she would just be, you would just throw her out as another establishment person. Like, Jimmy's been going after the whole squad as all of a sudden being like a, oh, go ahead, Matt, what were you going to say?
That's his goal, though. The reason he narrowed it and the reason he's like screaming over Stoller and Sirota when they're trying to list other things is because he only wants it to be narrowed to that one vote thing. Because he wants to do is be able to call the sellouts. He literally said it. Over Stoller, he doesn't give a fuck about like seeing the squad represented in leadership. Like he said, people don't vote for you for committees. Like, I'm sorry, but yeah, actually, that's a part of what like a problem with the squad is they haven't been represented in leadership. And right, like and
it's so, you know that to me is I think that's the biggest issue that you just brought up, and I think that's also sort of I mean I'm sure you guys mentioned it, but from what I saw online, that was sort of ignored. Like, it's good to have a diversity of tactics. It's good to have all these different people who have different ideas of the way forward, but everyone has to have an understanding.
And I want to call out Jimmy's defenders real quick because they all try to retcon him into being this both and person, and he's not. He's simply not. Right. How many times does he have to stress it that he only cares about this vote?
He doesn't read shit. He doesn't research. He doesn't know politics. I mean, that's what it is. He's misinformed and uninformed, actively ignorant and vitriolic. He's not a serious person. He's taken the anger that people feel towards Democrats and not representing them, and he's manipulated it to a grift. That's exactly what it is. And it disempowers people, as Jamie has said, which is such a good point. And that's why I think it's dangerous. And we had another caller from yesterday call in about this and made this great point. And then I'll leave it to you guys. But McConnell said in 2019, yeah, bring Medicare for All to the floor. I want to. Why? Because he knows they don't have the votes. And when you bring something to the floor responding and you don't have the responding to certain pressures, I guess, and you don't have the votes, that further hurts the viability of Medicare for All down the line. You have to be strategic about it. You have to whip votes and then make that case. But you don't do it just because some online leftist who has no familiarity with the situation is using that one specific thing when you could get other more realistic concessions like, you know, David Sirota, sellout David Sirota, obviously, is advocating for.
Yeah.
It's stunning to me, too, that they would, like to him, Medicare for All is the only thing that we can bring up right now because it's the perfect time because of the pandemic. I mean, I get that, of course, but there's a way more realistic proposal that's perfectly aligned for the pandemic as well. And that's just getting people their survival checks, which is the new sort of a term for it, is getting people their $1,200 or $2,000, whatever the current proposal is, get people that money. That'd be the most obvious thing to force people's hands on. Because people need money now.
Where I turned on Jimmy was like, I think the vote isn't bad, particularly if it's coupled with these other things. But when I just forgot what I was going to say. Go ahead.
No, did you remember? No, because basically, I agree with what you're saying too. Like, I really thought like what he was saying makes sense, and it's good that there are people who are advocating for that and putting pressure on politicians to take a position. But why is he spending his time going after the politicians who would vote for Medicare for All just because he wants to have that symbolic vote? Why not put all that energy you have to attacking AOC and the rest of the squad to attacking the non Medicare for All supporting politicians?
Went after Cori Bush, went after Jamal Bowman. Sorry, Jamie.
Oh, thanks. I was just going to say, it's not a bad idea, his idea, if that's all we have the power to do, right? If that's all we have the power to do is have this, you know, this spectacle, this floor vote on Medicare for All, that shows people who's on their side and who isn't, right? There is some value in that for the whatever amount of working class people still believe that the Democrats are going to protect their interests, right? I mean, I would argue that voters are already a more privileged category than non-voters. And also most of the people who voted for Joe Biden in this election did it with eyes wide open, not thinking that the Democratic Party and its leadership were anywhere near to getting us Medicare for all or doing anything other than like maybe defending the status quo from Republicans, right? So if that's all, if that's all we can do, then fine. But you know, and people are like calling me out now because I said that that wasn't a bad idea.
That reminds me of why, like, that's not good enough. That's not, like, that's still the primary. And what bugged me about it was people coming at me at the urgency. There's a pandemic. You think Medicare isn't a priority right now? It's like, no, you're saying, you're coming back saying, even if this fails, this is good ammunition for the primaries in 2 years. What are you talking about urgency for if we're talking about electoral campaign material? So no, anyway, sorry,
that's Jamie. That's a very good point also. But then, you know, I did something that maybe those people don't understand, which is I got new information and I changed my mind based on that information from David Sirota and AOC, all these ideas for things they could do that would actually remove some barriers towards Medicare for all, which I'm like, all right, if we have the power to do that, we should do that for whatever it may do. I'm still like skeptical that any elected Democrats would actually follow through on the threat to let a Republican become House Speaker. So I'm not really sure how much that's going to do either. But I mean, I had a tweet thread about this and my fundamental point still stands, which is this is something that is only going to be won if we have massive amounts of working class organizing and institutional power and class power in the streets. You know, AOC and the squad, this is not something that they would do for us if only they had the individual medal. You know, that is a fundamentally limited, fundamentally liberal way of looking at this, right? They can only do, like, yes, they want to do it. I believe them. They want to do it, but they can only do as much.
They also wanted to elect Bernie in the primary, and they couldn't do that either.
They can only do as much as they're able to do based on the balance of class forces in society, which right now are not in our favor. So until that happens, we're not going to get this. And it's not a matter of, you know, these individuals blinking or failing or not being progressive enough or whatever. And I saw that AOC liked some of my tweets in that thread, which means that I'm right.
But to bounce off what Jamie said, it absolutely means you're right. And I think that is a great point that, you know, we should come back to this, obviously, when there's been a mass movement to try to sway more people into voting for Medicare for all or getting even more ordinary citizens to back the proposal so that they would go ahead and call their senators and congressmen and House representatives to vote for Medicare for all. But to bounce off that, why is the idea that putting this to a vote would out the people who don't support Medicare for all? And why is it that idea that that would be what would happen? Like the idea, like you could go and see right now who supports Medicare for all. Like we know who supports Medicare for all. And what if it did go to the floor for a vote and it got voted down like it would, like it's expect, like expected at this point? And what if that just hurt the movement more so than help it? Like the idea that...
That's definitely a possibility, but it's also like, I'm not even sure that this would tell us who really supports Medicare
definitely
for all,
not,
because if they know it's going to fail, they can vote for it as posturing. Yes.
That's what the Republicans did with the Obamacare repeal all the time.
They knew it wasn't going anywhere. That's what Kamala Harris did in supporting this bill. That's what Kirsten Gillibrand did even though I actually think she's more legitimately in favor of it than someone like Harris. But that's what like all the Democrats who were banking on running in the presidential primary did with Bernie's bill.
Yeah.
Harris supported Medicare for all in the Senate, which means she's obviously still a Medicare for all supporter, right? Jimmy Dore's thinking here, you know?
And that's the
Jamie
thing.
Jamie Dore. Oh no.
You are not the first person who's called me that, Matt. Don't worry.
To get off Jimmy for a little bit, like I sympathize with like what Kyle Kalinske wants to happen, which is like this vote happens and it creates a groundswell of you know direct action that pressures Congress to do something, right? Would love that. But I need to hear less about protests and more about strikes. Because like Jamie mentions all the time, we had a massive protest movement last year and the amount is basically like some movement in select municipal areas on defund. But it certainly wasn't enough to on some of the line of Medicare for all. Mm-hmm. So you're gonna need a lot more than protests. So we need to hear this can't be, we're not gonna drag labor into this because we started, right? Like I don't think that can happen. I'm skeptical that maybe I'm wrong. But I think you're going to need those partners ready when you start trying to agitate day one. Because otherwise, I think this is just frankly pulling the left farther from labor in terms of like tactics. And I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. I could be wrong. I'm no expert on this thing, but it doesn't feel right to me.
Yeah. No, there's no way around it. Like, we need to connect up these movements in the streets with organized labor if we really want to exert class power. Because until we have the power to shut down production, circulation, and economic activity, we're not going to get what we want out of the bourgeois state, because that's what they ultimately care about and that's who they ultimately serve. Like Boots Riley was talking about it on Bad Faith the other day. A demonstration used to mean a demonstration of power. Like, look at all these people. Look at all this power that we have. You know, look at all these card-carrying communists who have their hands in organized labor and all sorts of areas of working-class life. And, you know, that's something that, unfortunately, there are no shortcuts. And it's not going to magically happen just because, you know, the veil falls from people's eyes and they realize our government is crap. Because most people already know that our government is crap, but they don't know what they can do about it. And we need to really relearn those skills.
Well, when looking at, I think, how to effectively message when it comes to, this is my attempt to pivot to a clip, but I don't know if I'm doing it that artfully. So I'll just start off like this. Okay. So Bernie Sanders spoke to the media about the coronavirus relief package and the complete stalemate and the fact that, well, I don't know if he mentioned this in this clip, but the House passed multiple versions of a coronavirus relief bill and McConnell only cared about it and the Republicans only cared about it when the election was near. And now that the Georgia runoffs are near, McConnell is getting nervous. And so he's trying to push anything through. Democrats do have leverage right now. And Bernie Sanders articulates a lot of this to Wolf Blitzer on CNN.
Americans have fallen into poverty. Now, these are people who had jobs, were making a living, they were paying the rent, buying food, doing what they needed to do. But now they are in poverty right now. And it's hard to believe this is going on. And what's so frustrating to me and so many others, why is it taking so long to help these millions of Americans?
Well, you know, I don't want to become overly political here, but it is clear to me that we have a Republican majority here in the Senate who has refused to entertain and still refuses to entertain the kind of funding that is needed to provide nutrition, to help people who are being evicted, to make sure that people in this crisis, can you believe it, in the midst of this terrible pandemic, everyone's afraid of getting the virus, and you got 90 million people who are unable to go to the doctor when they get sick. So many of us had fought for adequate funding, and we've met very stiff resistance from Mitch McConnell and the Republican leadership. But, you know, what we got now is not enough, but it is something. And I'm just simply happy to say that as we enter the holiday season, when so many people are worried about how they're going to pay their bills, whether they're going to get evicted, whether they're going to feed their kids, at least, among other things, there'll be $600 per adult. At $600 per child as well. So that's a start. I want to do better.
So obviously, even though you want more, you'll vote in favor of this compromise, whatever emerges. Is that right?
I want to read the bill. It's a long, long bill. But I'm feeling good that we have made some progress at least. You know, a week ago, as you know, nobody was talking about direct payments. We got something in the bill, and I want to thank my progressive friends in the House for their good work on this. We're making some progress.
Because, you know, as I often say, and I've said it to the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi and others, when you're dealing with a crisis like this, you can't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, because so many millions of people out there are suffering. You might not get everything, Senator, but you're going to get a bunch that will make life better for these people, right?
Well, one of the other things that we're going to get is extended unemployment benefits. As you've indicated, unemployment is very high. A lot of people have no income.
Yeah, the media always steering Bernie to accept the bill, don't use your power, accept the bill. But, you know, Blitzer is right in a sense. This is urgent. And the reason we even have stimulus checks is partly because of Bernie Sanders joining up with Republican Senator Josh Hawley, who unseated Claire McCaskill, and they were demanding $1,200 payments need to be included here. Also, in the House, Pramila Jayapal and the rest of the Progressive Caucus, they were using their leverage and were threatening to withhold their vote from any compromise bill and pressured Pelosi into being stronger on stimulus checks. So that's a great summation of how progressives have actually improved and used their leverage in this bill, because McConnell desperately, and he said in a phone call to Republican senators last night, Kelly and David, in terms of Loeffler and Perdue in Georgia, are getting hammered on this. They are nervous that if they don't pass a COVID relief bill, that this will hurt the Republicans' chances in Georgia, which means Democrats should try to squeeze as much juice out of this orange as possible before they do agree to a compromise.
Ooh, I like that. Squeezing juice out of the orange. That's a good one, Emma.
Yeah, yeah, there we go.
But it is stunning to me to watch yet another clip to see someone in the media, mainstream media, interviewing Bernie Sanders about this very important, serious, dire issue and like chastise him as if they're teaching him a lesson. We saw this with Stephanie Ruhle, over at MSNBC. Her producers or her team or her crew, whoever set this piece up, the segment up, they even had an on-screen graphic for her to go on the attack on Bernie when he said he's going to hold his vote until there's direct payments for people in the coronavirus relief bill. He says that, and they have it ready to go, a chart showing that, but Bernie, you've only ever passed 7 bills in your entire time in Congress. Who are you to demand this when you can't get anything passed? And then here you have Wolf Blitzer going ahead trying to teach Bernie that, you know, Bernie, you should know that it's better than nothing. You know, it's so frustrating. Like, who do they think they are?
We mentioned this context. Pelosi had also only co-sponsored, I think, around 7 bills in her time. So they selectively cherry pick that, even though Bernie Sanders has been very successful in getting amendments through in order to paint him as some sort of obstructionist. Like, they don't care about what's in the bill. They just want compromise for compromise sake. And it's amazing the media's constant bias in that regard, as opposed to looking at these massive stimulus packages, not big enough in this case, point by point, and talking about them on their merits.
I'm not a wonk on this stuff. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there weren't going to be direct payments in this bill initially, correct?
Correct. Right. And as I mentioned, just that.
That's insane.
And it was because of the progressive pressure from Bernie Sanders, from also, you know, Josh Hawley, who's clearly using this as a jumping off point for a presidential run in 2024. And then also the House progressives, Pramila Jayapal, you know, and then the squad and et cetera, using their power in order to get these payments in there.
God, imagine being a Democrat and thinking you should pass a bill without direct payments to people during a pandemic depression.
We should play that.
Insane.
We should Warner clip, unless you want.
Yeah, right. But one more thing, though. You know, it's interesting, though, that's how progressives get a lot of their wins. Like, that's how Bernie, through his entire career, has gotten a win, by forcing someone, the rest of Congress's hand, to inserting something into a bill that wasn't originally in that bill. But that's never chalked up on the old scoreboard for Congress members as, oh, Tack that on Bernie's 7 bills passed. But that's how they're most effective when you're in the minority in Congress. But look at how also, like, that's how sort of the Tea Party came to rise and how they forced Republican hands to pass austerity and all these cuts. The media is always happy to talk about how, like, the Tea Party or whatever Republican group at the time is able to rise to power and force Republicans' hands to doing things. But on the left side, when the progressives do that, they don't even contend. Is that part of their whole formula in deciding what do progressives like Bernie Sanders actually do? And it's like, I mean, I just want to put that out there because that's exactly what happens. Progressives get things done by forcing hands, and they don't chalk that up on the scoreboard as a win for progressives like they do for the Republicans.
It's harder. It's harder for progressives because I think the Tea Party ultimately was ideologically unified with the Republican Party and their project. It was a bunch of rich people who didn't want to pay taxes. Whereas in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, there is a real split. There is a real oppositional relationship. And it's always going to be harder when that kind of relationship exists, right? Because the mainstream Democrats have to do this double dance of pretending that they serve both labor and capital when we all know that left to their own devices, they only serve capital, right?
And management.
Yeah. And it's the job of these progressives for whatever power they may have and for whatever they may be able to do to, you know, to stand up to that.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to embrace your grassroots when their legislative agenda also helps your donors.
Yeah, let's tack on Holly first before we get to Warner. I got this clip of him. Because I think we've brought him up already because I think he's been here.
Is that part of the latest bill that was discussed last night among leaders?
I don't know the answer to that yet, Tony, but I certainly hope it is, because the most important thing that Congress can do now is to get assistance into the hands of working families and working people. These are the folks who should be first in line for COVID.
It loads here. I don't know what
COVID
happened,
relief.
The hope was about the $1,200, and of course we know that that isn't what it sounds like. It's not in there. It's halved.
Last, they shouldn't be an afterthought. Working people have borne the brunt of this pandemic, and they need direct support. And I'm willing to do everything I can, everything in my power, to make sure that they get it.
So that's probably enough. One thing that I would like to see from Josh Hawley, and I don't want to be like the sort of, I don't want to look a gift horse in the mouth here. So if Josh Hawley can get people checks, I want Josh Hawley to get people checks, and I want his vote on that stuff. But I also like want him to do something besides talk to the media about this. Like, how many judges has Josh Hawley approved over the course of the people needing checks through this whole time? And then the Senate comes out with their bill, and he thinks it's wild that it doesn't include direct payments. It's wild, Josh. Yeah, like, isn't Josh Hawley also Ivy League? You're surprised by, like, not wanting to give money? And then I also want to hear, you know, okay, it's great that there's one Republican in the Senate that wants checks. I genuinely believe that. I know my tone didn't make it sound like that. But is his vote coming at the cost of slashing unemployment benefits? Like...
He's not been clear about that, right?
Right, of course. Yeah. And so, like, I think there's a difficult line to walk here, because at the other hand, you have Mark Warner, who's just like, I understand why people freak out about Josh Hawley, you know, flanking the left, right? But I think we need to like also make sure we like, if he starts doing something that upsets Mitch McConnell, and he isn't just like, you know, what Jeff Flake was for decency, he's for material demands, right? Like just a PR thing to let some pressure out of the tire. And I think that's what he is right now, because he hasn't done anything to actually use his power. Yeah. So he says he's willing to do anything he can do. Why are you so behind on knowing if there's $1,200 checks or not? You're obviously not willing to even stay up to date on the state of play of this bill.
Yeah, I mean, but Bernie does this all the time, which is why that graphic is so hilarious from MSNBC, right? Where he finds opportunistic Republicans, like what he does with Yemen, with Rand Paul and Mike Lee, or different agendas in that area. Like, he capitalizes on that opportunism to get traction on something. Mm-hmm. So I hear you completely, Matt. It's probably performative, but
it's exactly what Bernie should be doing. You are right. I appreciate that he does it.
Yeah.
And like, this shouldn't be a political issue, right? Like, we know what we need to do to keep the economy from spiraling into crisis. And yeah, a lot of the politicians are sort of ideologically opposed, or, you know, the people who pay their, who donate to them are opposed to it. But like, it is just good economics within capitalism to do direct payments to people. So, you know, I guess good for Josh Hawley for understanding that. But that doesn't win him any like progressive points with me.
Yeah, I mean, the scary thing is like they're less concerned with keeping the like consumer economy afloat and more concerned with like making sure people have to work to feed themselves, even during a pandemic.
Like, well, that's become the new talking point, right? That's the new, that's their, I mean, I guess they didn't come up with it back in.
Well, the last. Sorry. Go on.
No, no, but like, you know, maybe they didn't come up with it back in March and April because we were in the thick of it then. But now that they see that it's coming to an end, or they realize that there's enough, you know, people out there who are just sick and tired of it, at least on the right, who want this whole lockdown and quarantine to end, and the coronavirus isn't even a thing. Come on. Trump's going to still be president. You know, those same people. They've calculated that, you know, they can use it politically to use it to force their to keep their talking points going in terms of the coronavirus coming to an end, just ending the lockdowns, getting back to normal. Service workers should be back in the restaurants. Open the restaurants already. Open the bars. I mean, if they vote to give people more checks, then they're basically admitting that this is necessary and that the restaurants and bars don't need to be opened up yet.
Yeah. Yeah. So, speaking of the stimulus and just the general attitude of centrist Democrats when it comes to this, Mark Warner of Virginia, who is one of the wealthiest members of the Senate, is talking like a straight up neoliberal about what is in this bill to cable news. And it's not helping the messaging at all when Democrats have McConnell over a barrel because he wants something to be passed before the Georgia runoffs.
And it included a full 16 weeks of a $300 a week plus up. We thought that was very important to get those people most in need. I think because the president and even some folks that call themselves progressives wanted stimulus checks more important than that assistance, you had to take it out of some pot. And I'm afraid that the relief for the unemployed may be a shorter period of time. But again, everything, none of these are perfect deals. I wish my Republican colleagues would have been willing to simply plus up the $900 billion that is in this aid. But I'm very proud of the bipartisan work that was done because, let's face it, 3 weeks ago, we were nowhere. 3 weeks ago, Congress is about to leave town as the ultimate Grinches before Christmas, yeah. As people would have lost their unemployment right after Christmas. They would have been kicked out of their apartments on January 2nd. We saw those lines at the food banks. They would have simply gotten worse. And I'm grateful that we're finally acting.
You would have looked pretty out of touch and callous had well, if you don't act still, it hasn't happened yet.
We would have looked like stupidity on steroids was my line. But I'm glad that, you know, frankly, it took this bipartisan group to break the gridlock. It is not a perfect bill, yeah. But at $900 billion, this is a lot of aid for people in need.
Oh, I hear your frustration on taking that money out of unemployment benefits. What about state and local funding? Because some of these municipalities, if they don't get any money, they're going to be laying people off. People will be out of work without funding.
Listen, I was a former governor. I know how important this assistance is. Matter of fact, 1.5 million state and local government employees have already been laid off. We had $160 billion in for state and local government, and I wish we would have had another day or two because I do think there was some appropriate liability protection that should have been put in place for responsible businesses, but the idea...
Okay, well... There he is kind of gifting the liability shield messaging to Mitch McConnell. But like, this is part of my frustration with the media here. Stop framing every compromise, regardless of what's in that compromise, as a win for the American public. Because first of all, that's Warner, I think yesterday, right? Was that yesterday, Matt?
Yes.
I think it was yesterday, yeah.
Okay. So at that time, direct payments were getting put into this bill, and it wasn't agreed upon yet. So he's prematurely making this distinction between, well, you know, I'd rather have the UI, the unemployment, than I'd rather than the stimulus checks. Dude, you're a Democrat. Why aren't you advocating for both? But he's a part of that narcissistic centrist gang with Mitt Romney and Joe Manchin who want a bill that's a compromise and are way less concerned with what that compromise entails than the appearance of compromise. And that's when people hate politicians, because it doesn't matter if you pass a blank sheet of paper. You know, it's not going to provide relief for the American people, but it makes them go back to their constituents and say, oh, I'm the deal maker. I'm the king maker. I'm the best senator there is. That's really what it's about. That's what they make it about. They make it about themselves as opposed to just fighting and being an advocate for people.
Also, to his point of he didn't want to leave. I know this is the point of the clip, but that he didn't want to look like he was out of touch. And then he went on to say, we're providing relief and people don't have to worry about being evicted coming January 1st. News for you, buddy. You are out of touch, because the money that those people are going to get isn't going to be enough to pay for all the back rent that's owed, because nothing was done to help renters. And plenty of people will be kicked out of their homes come January 1st if they haven't already been kicked out of their homes, regardless of what you've heard in terms of the CDC stopped evictions, or Governor Cuomo and local governors and state officials stopped evictions. They still went on across this country over the past few months, and many, many, many people have already been evicted. So the idea that this amount of relief is going to help those people is completely out of touch in terms of stopping the evictions. I mean, maybe you'll be able to put food on the table with those couple hundred dollars, but it's not going to stop your landlord from kicking you out of your home.
I don't want to sound out of touch, but let me reference the Grinch in the face of the largest mass eviction crisis in this country's
modern history. I'm not the Grinch. It's about him. Again, exactly, Matt, right? You're going to say, I'm not Ebenezer Scrooge. I'm not the Grinch. I'm not Beelzebub. No one gives a shit about how you're painted in the view of your Virginia constituents when it's not, again, and the media reinforces it. They just reinforced it in that Bernie Sanders clip. Well, you know, Bernie, don't you know that this compromise bill is going to help a lot of people? Do you know what's in the bill? Do you guys know what's in the bill? Because what progressives are fighting for substantively helps people more. And I just, the fetishization of being in the center of everything, regardless of what that center entails, is infuriating to me, because it enables the narcissism of people like Mark Warner and Joe Manchin and Mitt Romney to go out and be the heroes to the media when they're making it a false choice between unemployment and stimulus checks. And then that enables the Republicans like John Thune to go out there and say, well, I'm worried people are double dipping. I'm worried people are double dipping and they're going to get both a stimulus check and they're going to get unemployment. What? Yeah. You know what? That's reinforced by Mark Warner.
And you can hear it in the way that, you know, he answers Katie Tarr's question. She's like, you guys would have looked pretty callous if you didn't include any of these benefits or relief efforts in the deal. And he's like, yeah, I think we would have looked stupid on steroids. It's like, it's all about like how he would be represented in his image after the fact, not the fact that people would be starving and out on the streets.
Dude, that got me so mad.
Well, I mean, Mark Warner should be happy to know that he still looks stupid.
He looks like a monster. We need to start viewing these people as like actual, like, blood on their hands monsters. Because, like, the fact of the matter is, any monster you see in a horror movie is only probably killing maybe a dozen people. But the fact that, like, we're letting people just in mass get thrown out of their homes, it's a crime against humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I gotta look up Mike Myers' kill count now.
Being a senator is not about it's not about the appearance of deal making. I mean, it is about being an advocate for your constituents. Do they get that? I don't know.
To Matt's point, Michael Myers, in all of the Halloween movies he's appeared in, has only killed 121 people.
That's what I'm talking about.
There we go.
Well, you know what they say. If one person dies, it's a tragedy. If 1,000 people die, it's, I don't know, too big to wrap your mind around.
The statistic, yeah, yeah. You were like, yeah,
right.
You were 80% of the way there.
Well, you took me the rest of the way, and thank you for that.
I mean, we actually do see that with the pandemic, actually. You know, on 9/11, what was it, 2,000, somewhat, a couple hundred? What was it? What's the amount of people who died on 9/11?
It's like 3,000.
2,977 people died on 9/11. We are now surpassing that each day in the U.S. from COVID. And it's just, oh, just open up. No big deal. It's not happening. No big vax. Don't take the vaccination. That's terrible. There's no pandemic. It's all political to hurt Trump. Open up the restaurants and the bars and the stores and all that. I mean, Jamie's right. I mean, there's only, I guess, 2,977 people is the limit for us in the U.S. to take as a tragedy when it comes to death. And then anything beyond that, especially when it happens each and every day, that's just, oh, well, that's just what's happening.
Maybe if people did something really dramatic and, like, in front of their congressman when they died of COVID, like, exploded or whatever, they might care more. I don't know. But then again, you know, you have people who are suffering and dying from all sorts of knockoff effects as well. Like people who are out on the streets, people who don't have enough to eat. Like it might not be as noticeable for those in power, but it's real. And we have to keep on putting it to the forefront until, you know, people get organized in a way that scares the shit out of the ruling class and the people managing this economy.
For sure.
Let's go to the phones again. Let's go to 340. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Shen. I'm calling from the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Oh, hi, Shen. How are you doing? What would you like to talk about today?
What is the weather like there first?
It's hot.
It's snowing here.
But we have trade winds, so it's not like we don't have humidity. So it's actually pretty great. I can't complain. It's about 80 degrees.
I thought you were about to like mitigate it, except you just made it way better.
Yeah. I thought you were like, not so bad about the snow, you know.
Yeah.
So like, so other than the weather there, I'm assuming you wanted to talk about something else?
Yes. So first thing I wanted to say is that I had actually called into the show a few times before, and rest in peace to Michael. I actually had invited Michael to the Virgin Islands, and of course he never made it. So since he is no longer with us, Sam, I would like to extend that invitation to you. If you ever want to come to the Virgin Islands to cover something political, which would be awesome because we seem to get forgotten, because we're tinier than Puerto Rico, that would be great. I would be more than willing and happy to make sure that you're provided with good room and board.
Oh, what are the rest of us?
Well, I love you guys. You guys are all wonderful. Emma, you've been a great addition to the show. Jamie and the Max, I've loved you all since forever.
Thank you.
My husband and I are actually members. So you all are just wonderful people, and please keep doing what you do, because I actually live in Wisconsin, permanently. I was there for 11 years. So kind of going through the Trump presidency has been so traumatic on different levels, and even more traumatic knowing that I would never have been able to vote for president unless I moved here, even though I was born an American. That's terrible.
Right.
I have a little brother who's in the Air Force, and he will not be able to vote for president unless he decides to move to the mainland. So, but one of the issues that I actually really wanted to talk about today, which is actually nothing to do with the Virgin Islands, is in regards to Anjanette Young. This is a social worker in Chicago who had a group of 9 police officers armed in riot gear, armed with rifles, with scopes and all sorts of ammunition, break into her apartment looking for a criminal who did not even live there. She had just come home from work and she was completely naked. They threw a blanket on her, without trying to feel it. It covered her back for a few seconds before it fell off, further revealing her body. She went through this for 23 minutes. She was crying. She was screaming. There was nothing in her home that would have led them to believe that she needed to be investigated. It turns out it was all a bullshit mistake because an informant had said that they thought a criminal lived there. The criminal that the Chicago PD were looking for actually lived in another apartment in Anjanette's neighborhood. And that criminal was actually wearing an electric monitoring bracelet. That criminal did not need to be stormed at all because he was already being tracked by GPS. This incident happened in February of 2019, but it's only been recently brought to light because Anjanette had to fight in court to get the Chicago PD to release the footage of this assault. And CBS Chicago actually was involved in a lawsuit as well to get that body cam footage revealed. Mayor Lightfoot has apologized, but since this tape was released, there hasn't been any sort of retribution or justice for Anjanette. I am disgusted. I am a Black woman, and I cannot say in words what life is like for us. And when I watched this video of Anjanette, I knew for a fact that I was going to call in today no matter what. Anjanette has a GoFundMe. I do encourage others to support it because as a social worker, she's already active in a lot of causes to support local Chicagoans who are mostly Black and dealing with poverty. But her GoFundMe is pretty cool because she's going to take all of the money from my GoFundMe and donate it to the Progressive Baptist Church and their social justice ministry. Their social justice ministry provides legal assistance and support to Chicagoans who are facing situations like hers. So people who are beat up when they're arrested, people who are assaulted or harassed by police and normally would not have the funds or the resources to get any sort of help. So yeah, that's what I wanted to say today.
Thank you for calling in and telling us about that. I did not hear about that. It's I'm sorry, I'm hearing echo from the Zoom call again. But yeah, I mean, just another story that just on top of all the different social justice events that happened this year that shows why the Black Lives Matter movement is so important and why police brutality is such an issue. And again, while we're having this conversation about, oh, did defund the police hurt the Democrats or not? It didn't. But while this conversation is happening, here you have a perfect example of the very real ways that the police hurt people for, I mean, there's never a good reason, but in this case, this isn't even someone that should have been on police radar because she didn't do anything.
Yeah. Well, again, I think we see the system working as intended because its purpose is not to keep people safe. Its purpose is to terrorize surplus populations and, you know, pretty much everyone, keep them oppressed and keep people scared. And that's what they're doing in this instance. And I don't believe that this institution can be reformed. Obviously, it's a very good thing if they can hold those cops accountable. Don't get me wrong. But ultimately, the only way to fix this is to shrink police budgets so they have less ability to do shit like that in the first place. And I think it also points to some topical things about the Biden administration. You know, Rahm Emanuel covered up a racist police murder in Chicago. So the fact that he would even be floated or considered for any kind of post in the Biden administration is once again a huge, it's just spitting in the eye of the whole Black Lives Matter movement and the uprising that we recently had.
Thanks so much for the call, Chanel. Tell us that story. I mean, I'm so glad you did because I honestly had not heard of it. And now I'm going to take a look and find out more about it.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. And like I said, I do encourage you guys to donate. Even if you can't, just repost something. It's sickening the way it's kind of been ignored up until now. It's been a long fight to get that footage released. You know, this happened almost 2 years ago. So I think she deserves to be heard. So thank you guys for listening, and thank you guys for being wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
You're so nice.
Left is best.
Oh, love it.
Bye.
And when I said everyone earlier, I meant everyone but the capitalist class, obviously.
All right. There's no IMs coming in today. I don't know why. There must be another problem with the fans FM system. Kyle, take a look at it, Kyle, when you can. I'm getting the calls, so it's not a refresh issue. I'm just not seeing any IMs coming. You guys want to hit that Palin clip? Because whenever I see a Sarah Palin clip.
Yeah, that was.
It's been a minute.
Great minds, because that was my next idea for
right.
a clip. So Sarah Palin, the original Trump before Trump, same people, but Trump just did it better. He refined the craft, and she's too stupid. Yeah, not as smart as Trump. I know that's high par, but she's low on the IQ scale. She was speaking to Newsmax and, of course, recycling all of these Democrats are takers, or they want to take it money from working people and give it to people who are lazy and choose not to work. I mean, classic Republican nonsense that she tried to put
I'm sorry, Emma, did you just play the clip? I couldn't tell if that was actually Sarah Palin speaking.
How dare you? Play the clip so I can hide my seething rage at old Matt right now.
Yeah, and I truly believe that. And the reason we hear so much about them, of course, is because the mainstream media gives them a platform. But when you talk about where we're headed, I want to also talk about judges, because we have cowardice in this country. I see now judges afraid to do what's right. I see state legislators afraid to do what's right. And it put President Trump in a very terrible position this election. If the fraud evidence is true and it proves to be true, he could have had this election stolen from him, Governor.
Yeah, absolutely. It's baffling what we see in terms of the lack of courage. And, that's tragic for our country. We do see so many sheep just following those who I think are giving them the perception that things will be made easier for them if they'll just follow, these Democrat leaders like AOC. That clip that you just played of hers, holy moly. Do people hear what she's saying? She's saying, anybody who's working hard, you're out there working, you shouldn't be living in poverty. And of course, people like me were saying, well,
pause it for a second. I'm sorry, but Sarah Palin having the nerve to criticize AOC for, in Sarah Palin's view, not sounding very smart. And then the example is that people working should not be living in poverty. I mean, just, okay. I just had to stop and point that out. Go back to the clip.
Projection.
You shouldn't be living in poverty. And of course, people like me were saying, well, duh, AOC, then quit taking their money, those who are working so hard, and giving it to able-bodied people who are choosing not to work. The things that these Democrat leaders are saying today, they're so twisted. It's so Orwellian. Who would have thought that 1984, the book, was going to be their playbook? We know what's going on. We have to talk more about the solutions, Grant. And part of the
solution is... All right, pause it. I love when conservatives try to invoke 1984. I would love if someone asked her what the plot of 1984 is. Mm. Like, it would be akin to the Katie Couric moment when she was asked to name one newspaper that she reads. The idea that Sarah Palin has ever read 1984 is, I would bet my life savings on her never having read it and not being able to come up with one sentence of a synopsis about the book. But yeah, again, this is actually really bad messaging. And if mainstream Republicans want to go down this road, more power to them, because regular people know that there isn't work to be had. There aren't people who are just choosing not to work. This is as extenuating of a circumstance, COVID and the economic fallout, as there is, as there ever has been. I mean, even more so than the Great Recession. I think people really understand that it's unsafe to have some of these businesses be operating normally, and people aren't choosing not to work. They just literally, for health reasons, are unable to. So it's a bad, bad strategy for Republicans. And that's why McConnell wants to pass this relief bill, because he knows people are hurting and they want government assistance right now. So pretending like it's a personal responsibility thing, that's not going to play right now.
Well, there is work to be had, but it's dangerous work. Right? Like, you can get a job delivering food or stacking bodies at the hospital or whatever. It's also going to be a job where you're definitely going to get exposed to COVID. So, you know, she frames it as a choice, as people just being lazy. But a lot of people are like, no, I don't want to die. I've got family members at home who can't be exposed to COVID or what have you.
But on that point, even, I don't even think there is enough, you know, enough jobs out there for everyone who even wants to work and expose themselves and work in a field that can be dangerous for their health or their family's health. I mean, just a quick example. I mean, I just pulled up really quick. Who hires more for the holidays than Amazon? Amazon hired 100,000 seasonal staff. So again, there's a temporary position, but say you're someone during the pandemic really needs a job. Amazon's hiring 100,000 people. There are, as of the end of October, again, so these stats might be out of, this is a quick search I did while we were talking, 12.6 million people unemployed. And that doesn't even account for all the people who have fallen out of the system because they've been unemployed for so long and can't find a job, so they're not even looking right now.
I mean, I think the last numbers were 19, like almost 20 million that were officially on unemployment insurance.
Right. And it went up because, again, we're, a lot of states are now going back under lockdown since this stat in October. And restaurants are just closed down in New York City. So I'm sure they're closing down elsewhere as well. I mean, who does Sarah Palin and the Republicans who think like her, who do they think all these people are who are able-bodied and just are choosing not to work during this pandemic? I mean, just astounding.
And it's also like, who's Sarah Palin to talk about working people? She was a newscaster for about a year before she had a kid and then hung that dream up, which is sad. I mean, maybe that's part of what her tragedy is, because that's apparently what she wanted to do and had to give it up for when she got pregnant. And then after that, she was just a Republican figurehead politician at local to higher levels. So we hear Bernie get attacked for not ever having a job. Sarah Palin's definitely never had a job, and her time in public service has been malicious. So,
yeah, and she also, if I recall, presided over socialism and like handouts when what was the subsidies that she did with oil? I'm totally blank.
Oh, right. No, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah,
but
there was
I'm
like a dividend that all the
Alaska still has it. Alaska's had it for as long as I knew about it. I mean, it's been happening well before her, I believe, and after her. I mean, Alaska's known for being socialist-esque when it comes to every single Alaska citizen at the end of the year or whatever it is gets a nice fat check for doing nothing but living in Alaska, because the companies pay Alaska to basically get oil from the state, and they distribute it to all the citizens in the state.
The Alaska Permanent Fund, 1982. Thank you, Brendan.
There we go. Nice job, Brendan. Nice research. Because I vaguely had an idea of it, but I totally forgot. But yeah, I mean, she also, after she got famous, after the run with McCain, basically stopped wanting to be governor and had no interest in it and resigned to do her reality TV show. So,
All right. Yeah, I mean, Sarah Palin is just, she doesn't need to work, because she's just, she's just one of those people who's already above us. So we don't have to even question why someone in the elite, where they get their money from or how they sustain their living, is just assumed that they're more deserving than the peons. And, the peons have to prove their worth in the form of labor before we hand them anything.
Well, that is the Republicans' idea here, is they can force everybody into, lower and lower paid jobs in the service sector. And that's how, you avoid the moral hazard of just paying people to stay home during a pandemic, you know, don't want them to get too comfortable there. And they think that that's how you restart the economy, I guess. But, you know, if the COVID keeps surging, then the economy is going to keep getting messed up. Like, that's just economics.
All right.
Well, let's do one final clip and then we can wrap things up. The IMs still aren't working.
They just started coming in. I could read like two or three after this clip and then that'll be, we should be good.
Sounds good. Let's do this Rand Paul clip. So, Rand Paul was speaking to Maria Bartiromo, resident crazy person over at Fox Business. You know, she's competing with Lou Dobbs for absolute insanity. And he expressed concern that in the Georgia runoffs, that non-voters, traditionally non-voters, would be attracted to vote in the Georgia runoffs, which is literally the playbook for how you win elections. You turn out people who normally wouldn't turn out. The Rand Paul clip, yes.
But let me just get your take on the Georgia race. Are we going to see the same situation in Georgia on January 5th, where there were more ballots than actual people who voted, where there were ballots that weren't even folded, meaning they were never in an envelope, where the envelopes were separated from the ballots so you couldn't compare the signatures?
Well, there were 1,700 people that we heard voted twice. The Secretary of State needs to prosecute every one of them and deter them from doing it again. Their votes shouldn't be counted. There are thousands of people who voted from the wrong address in Georgia. Those people need to be taken out of the system, and they need to either re-register from a legal address or be prevented from voting from an illegal address. I don't know that they're doing any of that. And probably most importantly, they're mailing out a solicitation. They're mailing everybody out a solicitation to vote by mail. And this is not in the state law. This is something that has been created out of whole cloth by the Secretary of State. But if they do it again, yes, I'm very, very concerned that if you solicit votes from typically non-voters, that you will affect and change the outcomes. I'm very worried that Democrats will control all three branches of government, and they really, truly will transform America, but not for the better.
In your mouth, the God's wow. ears.
Wait a second. Is he implying that the Democrats are going to control the judiciary? Because lol.
Yeah, I know.
Right.
Yeah, of course. Like, the Republicans don't really know how to turn out traditionally non-voters. I mean, they did it with Trump, which was shocking to even them, right, in 2016. But traditionally, they just have their base that they drum up fear and anxiety in, and they turn out. But that's how Democrats win. And so he's kind of giving away the game there. Perhaps they are concerned more than they're letting on about Georgia. And, you know, to me, I still think it's going to go Republican based on the polling being within 1 point. And so that usually trends red. But there's something to be said for how concerned Republican senators are right now.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it is true that their people running are a big inspiration for negative partisanship. Just like Donald Trump was, right? Like, I've got a friend who lives in Atlanta. He doesn't always vote. He's a communist. He's like, screw all these people. But he's like, God damn it. I hate John Ossoff, but I hate Kelly Loeffler just a little bit more. And, you know, that might do it for the Dems.
These really might be the most two, like, obscenely over-the-top villainous Republicans. I mean, both of them with their profiting off the pandemic. I mean, so blatantly too, and it's been reported on, and it's defined who the both of them are. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if they won, but I also think if there's any way, shape or form, two Republicans could botch it in Georgia, especially after Biden won Georgia in an upset. I mean, these are the two that can do it.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to just a few IMs and then that's it. Eric Zachary says, I remember Michael saying the exact same thing as Emma did about Jimmy Dore a couple of years ago. He's a willfully uninformed outrage peddler.
If people should look up the video we did on TMBS about the passive aggressive progressive, because that was Michael ethering Jimmy after.
K.R. McNamee says, Sarah Palin has never read George Orwell. Hell, she's never, ever read Curious George. Matt in H-Town says, Sarah Palin is absolutely correct. We should stop giving Wall Street our money. And Leftist Best points out that Sarah Palin was literally talking about people not working hard enough with a polar bear rug and a huge gas-burning fireplace in the background of her mansion. Mm-hmm. And as Matt pointed out, she had like a huge white Christmas tree in the back, too. I mean, that doesn't mean anything.
Disgusting.
But,
I mean, that's a war on Christmas. Get a green... It should look like a pine tree. What's going on? This Melania Trump fashionista Christmases.
Real Americans dip their trees in frosting, all right?
It's funny you say that, because I'm on that train in terms of your Christmas tree should be green, and it's, even if you get a fake one like I do, it should look like a Christmas tree that grows outside. It should be psychos. Green. But this year, my five-year-old saw a white Christmas tree at Michael's, the art store, and he was so adamant about having a white Christmas tree that we now have a white Christmas tree.
Oh, my God.
We lost the new generation.
No. Okay. Well, guys, it has been an absolute pleasure joining you guys on the Fun Half on Thursdays. Matt, Jamie, and now and Brendan, and now Emma too. In a year so hard as this, this has been, you know, Thursdays, but you guys have been a bright point of the week, and I hope that the listeners feel the same way. Because I think it's been a lot of fun. Maybe they feel differently, but otherwise, that's all I got to say, I guess, to close out the last Thursday of the year. I know we're wrapping it up. So, guys, Matt, you got Left Reckoning tonight, right?
Left Reckoning tonight at 7.
Then right after that, youtube.com/Matt Binder for Doomed.
Awesome. And the Antifada for Jamie.
That's right. Thank you, Emma.
Oh, yeah. All right, guys, take care. Have a great holiday. Happy New Year. The rest of the MR crew is back tomorrow.
You're where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. The finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Kick it in my pocket.